Kelly Kasser Jane Show, Talk Radio for Fine Minds, airs Wednesdays, 3 p.m. Eastern, and is always available for your listening pleasure at HallieKasserJane.com. And is illusion alive and kicking now? Talk to me, David.
You're right. It is an illusion, but it's also something that these ordinary people had to live. They knew how to live it. They knew how to maintain that illusion that had been so carefully created for and about them. We'll never see their likes again.
Illusion, one of my favorite words. And today on the Hallie Kasser Jane Show, illusion is our subject. Hi, and welcome to the Hallie Kasser Jane Show. I am Hallie Kasser Jane. Thank you so much for tuning in. Today, we go behind the veil, that is illusion, with a behind-the-scenes look at both the White House and the golden age of Hollywood. Joining me at my table today is the author of The Residence, Inside the Private World of the White House, Kate Anderson Brower. And in our second half hour, the authors of In the Company of Legends, Joan Kramer and David Healy. But before we begin, today, the Hallie Kasser Jane Show is brought to you by Audible.com, a leading provider of spoken audio information and entertainment. Get a free audiobook and 30-day trial today by signing up at www.audibletrial.com/The Hallie Kasser Jane Show. And remember, The Hallie Kasser Jane Show is always available online at HallieKasserJane.com and a host of venues including iHeartRadio, Stitcher.com, Spreaker.com, and Blog Talk Radio. Kate Anderson Brower covered the White House for Bloomberg News and Business Week. As part of the White House press corps, she traveled on Air Force One, accompanying President Obama on dozens of trips worldwide. She was assigned to cover First Lady Michelle Obama and Vice President Joe Biden. Brower, a graduate of Barnard College with a master's degree from Oxford University, worked at CBS News in New York and as a producer at Fox News in Washington, D.C. In her new, much-talked-about book, The Residence, Inside the Private World of the White House, Brower sheds light on the 96 full-time staff members devoted to the maintenance of the White House and to the comfort of the families who inhabit it. Drawing on hundreds of hours of interviews with butlers, maids, chefs, florists, doormen, and other staffers, as well as former First Ladies and First Family members, the book offers a never-before-seen glimpse behind the scenes of the People's House and a never-before-seen look into the personal lives of the presidents and the families which they serve. Let's talk.
So, Kate, I got to tell you, this is really a terrific read. I mean, how eye-opening. What got you started on this?
Well, I covered the White House for Bloomberg News for 4 years, President Obama's first term, and I was on maternity leave, actually, after our first child was born, and I was just binge-watching Downton Abbey. This was in 2012, and it reminded me of a lunch that I was invited to with First Lady Michelle Obama, and it was, I had been in the White House, you know, more than 100 times just covering events in the East Room and whatnot, and I had never been in this kind of hidden room tucked away by the state dining room. It's called the Old Family Dining Room, and it was just a beautiful, elegant lunch, and a butler was floating in and out of the room, and it just felt, it felt like we were in, you know, the Four Seasons, and Mrs. Obama clearly had a rapport with him, and so it just made me wonder, you know, who are these people behind the scenes, and it kind of is our own version of Downton Abbey. We don't have anything else like it. There's no Buckingham Palace here to compare it to, or palace, you know, aristocracy. And so this is really what we have. And it was an incredible journey. It took 2 years to report, and it was really a lot of fun to get to know all these people.
Oh, I'll bet it was. And I can't wait to get into that nitty gritty with you in a second. Interesting how romance centric the Brits series, those Upstairs, Downstairs, Downton Abbey, Gosford Parks are. And this very little romance running in the behind the scenes in the White House.
Right.
It's gosh darn hard work, you know, and I think people don't, you know, who would have ever thought about it? So who are these people who shared so much of this with you? I mean, give me some examples.
Well, there were more than 50 former resident staffers and one current part-time butler who I interviewed. And they really are, you know, they're the butlers, maids, engineers, plumbers, florists, cooks, chefs, so who make the White House run. And they're 96 full-time staffers at the White House. And they are just fiercely loyal to each first family, and it's incredible. I mean, I interviewed one person who was head of the storeroom named Bill Hamilton, and he started in the Eisenhower administration. So he is the longest-serving resident staffer in modern history, from 58 to 2013. I mean, that's just an incredible period of time. But the book covers 10 different administrations, and it goes back 50 years.
Unbelievable. You know what I'm fascinated with? I'm fascinated with that word loyalty, a word that seems almost extinct in these kind of me-centric times that we live in. Talk to me about that. How hard was it to get the fiercely loyal help to talk to you? Because there was a time when they wouldn't have divulged anything about the goings-on in the White House. That seems to have changed, and maybe it's your talent to get people to talk?
Well, most of these people had never been approached by a reporter before. So it was just simply that no one had asked them. You know, people, I think, wrongly assume that, oh, they can't talk to you. But, I mean, if you check, a lot of these staffers, J.B. West, who was the chief usher at the White House, wrote upstairs at the White House. They have written books. But this is a unique way, because I think I get kind of a lot of different staffers to talk, like across the board, people who do different things, and I give an overview of what those jobs are. You know, I had no idea that there was a plumber at the White House. I guess you just never think about it.
Right.
And so it was difficult. I mean, it really took 2 years to get them to open up. I would go out to lunches, have coffees, talk on the phone, check in a lot. I mean, it's sad too, because one of the butlers who I really, really liked, Linwood Westray, and he was wonderful. He started during the Kennedy administration, and he passed away recently. Mm-hmm. And another painter, Cletus Clark, passed away recently. So I've been going to funerals, and it's amazing, too, that the first families attend some of these funerals. I mean, James Ramsey, a longtime White House butler, was a favorite of George W. Bush and Laura Bush, gave his eulogy, you know, in person at his funeral in D.C. You know, she traveled from Texas, and it just goes to show how close they become.
Something that stood out to me, and that's the work ethic of these people. They're unbelievable. Mm-hmm. This is the People's House, or what President Harry Truman called this great white jail.
Yeah.
And what did Michelle Obama say? She described it as a really nice prison. They get themselves.
Well, it really is.
Well, for sure. Absolutely. They get themselves all tangled up over the process of even making a bed, the sleigh bed in room 328. Talk about that.
That was
hilarious.
I love that story, because they backstairs at the White House, they refer to these rooms by room numbers as though they're hotel rooms. And room 328, yeah, has this infamous sleigh beds that one of the maids told me everyone dreads making, because sleigh beds are so hard to make. But, I mean, it really is like a fancy New York apartment. That's what one Obama advisor told me. And it's funny, the chief usher who will escort President Obama from the residence to the West Wing, you know, President Obama will bring things up like the Wi-Fi and the plumbing. And, you know, who else is he going to talk to about that stuff? You know, just problems that anybody has in their house.
It's true. So for all intent and purposes, besides being the residence for the leader of the free world, free leader, maybe we'll have a female soon, who knows, right?
Mm-hmm.
But presidents come and go. The staff doesn't. It remains. And that, to me, is interesting. Also, I see this place almost as a museum. Mm-hmm. What about you?
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely our most public-private home. It's also a home, too, right? I mean, we don't think of it in that way. And I interviewed the Johnson daughters. I interviewed three former first ladies and the children of four presidents, including, you know, the Nixon girls, the Johnson daughters. And Lucy and Linda Johnson describes having to listen to Vietnam protesters in Lafayette Square, you know, and they could hear them shouting, you know, hey, hey, LBJ, how many boys have you killed today? And it's a very hard position to be in, because you are right there in such a public place, and you really never feel truly alone. But the staff's job is to make you feel like this is your sanctuary, you know?
Did they like living in the White House, or what was their...
Oh, Barbara Bush loved it. She told me she wished she could go back and not have the responsibility of being first lady. Rosalind Carter painted a different picture. She said, you know, she trusted the staff completely, and she was grateful to them because the Iran hostage crisis is going on, and they would give her time alone on the Truman balcony with the president just to relax, because he was absolutely under so much pressure during his time in the White House. But at the same time, she was overwhelmed by just the money. It costs a lot of money to live in the White House because they pay for all their food. And she described her first food bill, and she was just astonished. It was $600, which, you know, in the 70s was a lot of money, and they get charged for every little thing that they eat and that their friends eat. And I don't think most people realize that. And, you know, obviously the Carters had the money to pay for it, but she would often ask for leftovers. And it's not a cheap place to live.
No, it certainly is not. Here's another thing. There's something old world about it. And, you know, I just read a very funny thing. You'll appreciate that. So that millennials are selling off their mother's china and place settings. And, you know, there's no place for Waterford Crystal in the real world anymore, right? And this place, they're putting flower arrangements in rooms that nobody's been in 14 years. Talk to me.
Yeah, I love that. One of the people I interviewed, Reed Cherlin, who was a West Wing staffer, you know, he described how wonderful it was, you know, to just wander around the halls and you'd see like a beautiful vase with gorgeous flowers and in a little spot where no one else will ever go. But it's a lot about, appearances. And Nancy Reagan, in fact, when the Gorbachevs, I mean, their famous visit to the White House in the 80s, made sure that the florist changed the flowers three times in one day to sort of knock the socks off of Reza Gorbachev. It's important that the White House look a certain way and that the china is gorgeous. And it should be, I think, an important part of our history. And that's what's amazing about these people is that they are not partisan people. They don't care if it's a Democrat, Republican, man, woman, black, white. They are there to serve.
I lived in Washington for most of my life. I don't at the moment, but I usually did. And you know from living in Washington, it's a southern town.
What is that famous Kennedy quote? You know, southern efficiency and northern charm. Or
right,
something.
Right. And so, all of that, Washington just has that feel. And I'm sure that's what penetrates, you know, the behind the scenes world of the White House as well. It's just something that's just there. Let's talk another thing. We have our own changing of the guard. It's not necessarily, you know, who's standing outside the White House. But boy, those couple of hours between changing of administrations, I think that is such an amazing thing. That really tells you how hard these people work and what they do. Tell us about that.
Yeah, it's, every 4 to 8 years, like clockwork, it is an entirely new job. And one of the chefs told me that he's never had a job quit him before. But at the White House, you know, you have to get used to an entirely new administration, new food, new ways they like the beds made and everything. And the staff has 5 hours to move the new first family in and the departing first family out. And it's really amazing. I mean, I had no idea before I started working on this book that they do it themselves because of security reasons. So a moving van will pull in and it's really all hands on deck. So you have maids and curators and florists just, you know, putting picture frames on tables. They do everything. I mean, they put out the president and first lady's toothbrushes. They unpack their clothes and put them in the dresser drawers. And the interior decorator of each first family is kind of watching them, advising them on where certain paintings go. But just, you know, it's very important that people, that a mover who's not cleared through security doesn't just wander into the White House. So this does make sense. But, you know, the press and everyone's eyes are trained on the Capitol and the swearing in. And all this is going on at the White House. It's just funny. All the real action is back at the White House.
Right. And the efficiency. I mean, you can't underestimate the efficiency of the people who run this place. Look, change of subject. Race. Interesting, for the first time in its history, the resident of the residence is a man of color and his family. There are a disproportionate number of African Americans working in domestic capacity, and we use the word domestic with their agreement, right? I don't want to just...
Oh, absolutely.
Right.
They're happy to call themselves
absolutely.
Domestic.
Yeah. Women can do it at home as well, those who stay at home. Some of these people are part of families that have worked at the White House for generations, but the better paid jobs, the ushers, the florists, the executive chefs, and those, that what? They get better, they're better paid. What was it like for the black staff to find themselves first? And this is a big one, I know, but working for their first African-American, I think that's amazing. Let's go there.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I interviewed Desiree Rogers, who is Obama's first social secretary, and she said clearly the look on the butler's faces, they were just thrilled. I mean, and the butlers who I interviewed told me they never thought this day would come. They never thought when the first chief usher, the first African-American chief usher was appointed in 2007 by President George W. Bush, and they told me they never thought they'd see the first black chief usher, let alone the first black president. So it was an amazing moment for them, and it's fascinating. I mean, the president himself has said that the butlers, the black butlers, look at Sasha and Malia, and they see their own children, their own grandchildren. And, you know, it raises a fascinating question. I mean, Michelle Obama has relatives who were maids, and the president famously talked about race in 2008. So, but it's an unspoken bond that they have, you know, that they've all gone through what it's like to be black in America. And, you know, there are really interesting stories about the Temptations and James Brown and all these amazing acts coming to the White House in the 60s. And they would hang out with the black servers in the butler's pantry and, you know, eat with them, hang out with them by choice before they performed. And in fact, one butler told me his greatest regret is that one of the Temptations said, "Why don't you come back to the hotel, invite your kids to swim tomorrow?" And he said he just got too busy, and now he's just kicking himself. But I interviewed Otis Williams, who's the last surviving member of the Temptations, and he remembered going to the White House and hanging out with them, and it's just, it's incredible.
There's another story that, this goes back, I think, to, I forget whose administration it was. It was Miguel Gorbachev was there, and President Reagan, that's who it was, and it was about to rain.
Yeah, and one of the ushers, so the concern was that the white ushers, the mostly white ushers, were standing there, and the chief usher, Gary Walters, was worried that it would look bad if it was, you know, the image was Gorbachev and Reagan standing there with a black butler, you know, holding umbrellas over them. So he quickly got this white usher named Chris Emery and summoned him up on the stage and said, "You're going to stand there because we don't want to look like the last plantation." And, you know, in that visual, you can see where they would think that it certainly wouldn't look good. But these staff were treated really well. I mean, I interviewed the son of Eugene Allen, and Eugene Allen was the sort of fictional, his life was fictionalized for the butler. And his son said, you know, that his father was treated really well at the White House, and that if anyone was mistreated, they would find themselves, quote unquote, being sailing out of the gate, that the first family would know about it, especially if it was a butler, and they would not be happy.
Unbelievable, isn't it? I mean, and you know, it's funny, from Europeans' point of view, they could probably care less about the color of a person's skin. This is so American that we get on, you know, it's that there is that side of it too. First families bring their own personalities and style to the White House. So let's go back to President Nixon. In the book, electrician Bill Clyburn was one of the just a few people in the Oval Office. And when Nixon announced his resignation,
That was a great story. I mean, Bill Clyburn was one who was a tough nut to crack. I mean, I called him a couple times and he was not interested in talking. And then eventually I asked him if I could just come over because he doesn't live that far away from me. And I did. And he and his wife, you know, I sat with them at their kitchen table, and he had such interesting stories to tell. And one of them was he was the chief electrician, and he was one of the few people allowed in the Oval Office when Nixon announced his resignation. And it was a very obviously somber mood. And after the announcement, Bill walked out to walk down the West Colonnade to go back to his office in the basement of the White House, and he heard footsteps behind him, and it was President Nixon. And Bill stepped aside to let the president go around him, and the president said, "Walk with me for a minute, Bill." And the two of them walked along the colonnade just for a moment, and Bill said, "You know, you did the best you could." And President Nixon said, "I wish a lot of people felt that way." And Bill told me it looked like the president was about to cry, and the two parted ways the ground floor of the White House, and President Nixon went back up to the residence. And I mean, it's very sad hearing about him because Watergate just dragged on forever. The staff didn't know they were leaving until Pat Nixon called asking for packing boxes.
Wow.
And there's another scene where President Nixon, normally he ate a very light breakfast, but the day that he left, he had corned beef and hash, and he thanked the head chef, Henry Haller, and said, "I've never eaten so well in my life." And it's just a more sympathetic view of these people because they are all human beings after all.
Absolutely. And I think that's the brilliance of this book, by the way, because I do think you humanize, through your research, you wind up humanizing people who, you know, are not dimensional in our world. They're
right.
Not, you know.
That was my goal.
Yeah, and well, you succeeded, darling.
It's hard to get to know them. Absolutely.
Absolutely, for sure. There's another one. Usher Preston Bruce recalls hugging the president and weeping with him on LBJ's last day in office.
Yeah, he was there. Preston Bruce was beloved by the by everyone, really. Kennedy, especially. They were very close. And he was with Jackie Kennedy in the elevator, and JFK's brother-in-law, you know, Bobby Kennedy, and they were all broke down sobbing. And he was also in the elevator with Nixon when he left and, you know, walked out on the South Lawn right before he made that famous peace sign. They broke down crying together, and Preston Bruce just said, you know, I wish that this day had never happened. And it's interesting that the elevator in a lot of scenes is the one place where these presidents really can be alone. You know, there
right.
Even in the second and third floors, there are people watching them, but in the elevator, they feel a little bit more free to let their emotions out.
LBJ was obsessed with the White House plumbing, and one of the staff got so stressed out by having to serve this man that he had a nervous breakdown. It's not all roses.
Right. It's hard to believe. I mean, I never knew the extent of this until I started the research. I mean, they ended up putting in four different pumps, and they had to increase the size of the water lines, which were sucking other parts of the White House dry. Johnson pulled aside the chief usher and said, "If you can't get the shower of mine fixed, I'm going to have to move back to the Elms," which was his Washington, D.C. house. And he wanted the, he had six different shower nozzles pointing at all parts of his body. And he wanted it to have a fire hose strength intensity, never wanted it warm. He wanted cold to hot. And he would call the head plumber, and he would get really upset and say, "If I can move 10,000 troops in a day, you can fix the shower any way I want it." And the irony of all of it is that Richard Nixon came in and took one look at this elaborate setup and just said, "Get rid of this stuff." You know, so 5+ years of obsessing about the shower, and, you know, Nixon didn't want it.
Oh, my gosh. Oh, my gosh. Oh, my gosh. Here's another one. Pot in the White House. Give me a break.
Yeah, the Carter sons would come and stay from time to time in the third floor of the White House. There were three of them, and they were, you know, in their 20s. And one of the florists told me, and this was on the record, a lot of these interviews are on the record, he told me that he would regularly have to move bongs. And another staffer confirmed that. I don't know if that's terribly surprising. It's certainly funny. And obviously pot was illegal. And, you know, if they had been caught with it anywhere else, it would have been a problem.
At the end of the day, the White House is like every other house in America.
Exactly.
You know, symbolic of the times.
Exactly.
Some of the staff admitted they knew about the affair between President Clinton and Monica Lewinsky. And they also talk about blood being all over the President and First Lady's.
Yeah, that story is probably the one that's gotten the most attention. And I guess I could have predicted that with the timing
right.
of the book.
Of course.
But, you know, one of the staffers said that they were called up to the president and first lady's bedroom, and there was blood on the bed, and that they all thought that Hillary Clinton clocked them with a book. There was a lot of arguing. The president said he walked into the bathroom door in the middle of the night. But it was a tumultuous time for them. The entire 8 years of the Clintons was a tough time for the staff, because they felt that the Clintons never really knew what they wanted, you know, and the Obamas and the Clintons weren't used to having staff. And I think that is a real difference. They didn't like feeling like people were watching them. They wanted the phone lines to be made into private phone lines, just like at any house, so they could dial themselves. And when the president picked up the phone and an operator answered on the other line, he said, "What the heck is this? I want to make a phone call. I don't want to have to go through an operator." And one of the ushers said that really negated the security system that they had in place for years.
You know, when I read that part, you know what I was thinking? I was thinking that it was symbolic of modern day presidencies, which, mm-hmm. you know, really began with Clinton. You know,
because now Obama can, I mean, President Obama can just make a phone call himself on his cell phone. Right,
right? Exactly. It's also different. It can't be easy for the residents of the resident or the staff. Privacy is at a premium on 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue. Florist Ron Payne recalls that after Carter lost his reelection bid, as we discussed earlier, he sobbed uncontrollably. I mean, these are these are some of the stuff that's revealed in this book. Painful, and what? Could it be vendetta? What? Why are some of these people dishing this dirt?
Well, I mean, Ron Payne told me that, and then I confirmed that with someone else off the record, just so I knew, you know. But Ron did leave the White House. He was not happy when he left, but he was well-liked among the staff. And so, you know, he did dish about a lot of stuff, and I did my due diligence to make sure that what he was saying was indeed true, because several other people said, yeah, that is right. I mean, even Rosalynn Carter told me herself that it was very hard. I mean, they lost that election in November. And think of it, they have to stay in the White House until January. And it's humiliating. And especially in that case where President Carter was dealing with the Iran hostage crisis that consumed 444 days of his time in the White House. And the Iranians eventually released these hostages like a few minutes after President Reagan was sworn in. It was incredibly humiliating for him. He had devoted so much time to that. And then, you know, and the staff really had to cater to him because the time difference with Iran. So he would be working in the Oval Office all hours of the night trying to free these hostages.
Yeah. The whole story is just utterly fascinating from soup to nuts. Everything that you put in this book is great. The one person I want to talk about before we close is Nancy Reagan and her screaming fit.
Yeah. And that was told to me on the record by Christine Limerick, who was the head housekeeper. And Nancy Reagan was a perfectionist, and she didn't want any gray food on serving platters. Everything had to be lively. She was very involved. There's one scene where a chef tries three different desserts, shows her three different dessert options, and she didn't like any of them. And he said, I have 2 days until the state dinner, ma'am. I need to know what you want. And she said, you have 2 days and two nights. And so he, you know, worked day and night to get this dessert right. But she got very angry about some of her Limoges porcelain boxes being broken. A couple other tchotchkes were broken. And she demanded that all of the things be put away for several weeks. And the head housekeeper, Christine Limerick, was just so upset because she really chewed her out, Christine told me. And Christine said she realized that she had to take a break because she was getting close to talking back. And you just cannot talk back to the First Lady. So she left for 5 years and returned. And she is by far one of the most beloved people at the White House. So I absolutely believe anything she says. And also a lot of these people, even when they say negative things, try to paint them in a positive light. You know, they say, yes, Nancy Reagan was tough, but we always knew what she wanted, and she was happy if you gave her what she wanted.
Yes, people like that with that kind of ability to manipulate and maneuver. That's why they work in the White House and you and I don't. So listen to me, Kate. While you're doing all of this, did you ever think, geez, this is just juicy stuff, but maybe we'd be all better off, you know, following that old adage that, you know, what goes on in the White House should stay in the White House? I mean, after what you revealed in your book, honestly, why would any resident of the residency trust anyone whose job it is to serve them? I mean, is the residence, as President Truman said, a prison, or is it a stay in solitary confinement? I mean, really?
Well, I think most of these stories pay tribute to the staff and their hard work. And I really wanted to do that because I don't think anybody realizes what it takes to run this 132-room house, you know. But even, you know, the staffers who work there would not talk to me, and I didn't want to put them in a position to talk to me, frankly, because it could get them fired. So they are safe to know that, like, the staffers who are there now will not say anything. And like I said, even these negative stories, and I mean, trust me, there are plenty of things that I'm sure they did not tell me that would be incredible to know. And I think we have a right to know more about these public figures who we elect, especially the president. You know, this is someone we elect, and most of these stories are really humanizing and positive.
Anything you chose not to put in the book?
Yes, actually. I'm glad you asked that. Yeah, there are some things that I thought were, wow, a little bit much to put in there. I definitely, gave it a careful consideration what I put in, what I left out.
Kate, this is really a genius work. I have to give you credit for it, and I'm going to say that on air. Talk to me. How did it change you?
Oh, gosh. I mean, it was just so much fun to talk to these people and really delve into their lives. It's also been really bittersweet because, you know, Linwood Westray, I became really close with, and I would check in on him every now and then, and he passed passed away before the book came out, and I really wanted to share it with him, so I've sent it to his daughter, and I'm trying to send it to other children whose, you know, relatives have passed away, because it's just, you know, I've talked to them in the last years of their lives, and I don't know, some of these people in their 90s seem so vivacious to me, I just wouldn't have thought that he would have passed away. So that's been hard. I mean, it's gives you a respect for these people who, you know, never dish, never tell any, and Linwood really never said anything negative, and neither did James Ramsey. They're incredibly loyal.
I've been speaking with Kate Anderson Brower, author of The Residence, Inside the Private World of the White House, by way of HarperCollins. For more information on Kate Anderson Brower and her book, visit Kate Anderson Brower, author, on Facebook. Starting with their award-winning profiles of Fred Astaire in 1980, Joan Crawford and David Healy documented the lives and careers of some of Hollywood's greatest legends, establishing a reputation for finding the unfindable, persuading the reluctant, and maintaining unique relationships with the stars long after the end credits rolled. Their programs have received 5 Emmy Awards, 20 Emmy nominations, and many other national and international honors. Now, for the first time, we can read all about their extraordinary experiences in their new, unbelievable book, In the Company of Legends, with a foreword by Richard Dreyfuss. The book filled with amusing and poignant portraits of the famous and the powerful with whom they worked. The kings and queens of old Hollywood, with stories of Katharine Hepburn, Jimmy Stewart, Johnny Carson, Frank Sinatra, Ronald Reagan, Paul Newman, to name a few. Let's talk.
Okay, Joan, ladies first.
Hi.
Talk to me, darling. A little background. You were born in Chicago and you were a ballet dancer. And what? How'd you get into all of this?
Well, I was an assistant choreographer, and believe it or not, I enjoyed putting the pieces together for a production more than I enjoyed appearing in that production. And so when I stopped dancing, I happened to be watching the Mary Tyler Moore Show, as many people did, and I think it was important for women to see that show because I thought to myself, gosh, she's doing for a television show as her character the kinds of things that I was doing for this choreographer. So I called all 3 networks and asked if there were any jobs available, and I wound up landing at the Dick Cavett Show.
My favorite person in the whole wide world. I think I told you that off air. David, do I hear the King's English in your voice, or where are you from?
There's still a little bit of leftover British English in my voice, yes. I was born in the north of England, and I lived in Britain until I was, 28, and then I moved to the States. So it's still there, although I'm very much American now. I think of myself as a New Yorker.
You're a New Yorker. Then the way you just said New Yorker, yeah, you're a New Yorker. I think that's unbelievable. I love it. But so how did you get into this? Because I know you started with the BBC, but then what?
Well, yes, I actually got a degree in physics, of all things, I managed to land a job at the BBC as an engineer because of the physics degree. What I was able to do, which is apparently very rare, I was able to leap over from engineering into production, and I worked at the BBC for 8 years in total, and I became a staff director there. So when I came to the States, I was looking for work as a director, but it was very tough. And back in those days, it's hard to believe it, but we didn't even have video cassettes to carry around with us. So when I told people what I'd done, they pretty much had to take my word for it. And I eventually landed a job as an associate director at New York's public television station, WNET, and climbed the ladder from there. And then Joan and I met.
Joan, tell me how you met.
Well, I was writing some intermission segments for Live from Lincoln Center when Robert McNeil, formerly of the McNeil Lehrer Report, was the host of those segments. And he said to me, when we began to chat, he knew of my dance background, and he said to me, WNET is starting a local art series, and I think you'd be a good candidate to work on it. And I thought, oh, I don't want to work for public television, I don't think. I mean, I never really thought about it. And he said, why don't you give me your resume, and I'll pass it along to the executive producer. And dummy Joan here said, you know what, Robin, maybe, everybody calls him Robin. I said, you know what, Robin, maybe I should send it myself with a cover letter. And he said, no, it would be much better coming from me. So he did, and I was the only person on the staff of what was called Skyline, the series, and later Skyline with Beverly Sills when it went to its third season and they hired Beverly as the permanent host. I was the only one on the staff with a dance background and the only one hired from the outside. Everybody else was hired from within the station for that series, and that's where I was assigned to David.
And assigned to David. So, David, what was your first thought when you met her?
We were too busy to have too many thoughts. I remember seeing her. She was sitting at the end of a long office, and it was a very busy series. So we, apart from the usual politenesses, we didn't talk very much until we started doing the first show together, which was about a stage and set designer, Ruben Terrarotunian. And nobody had done a show about stage and set designers before, so it was a well worth show, well worth doing. But it was almost traumatic. We had a very rough time putting it together. And Joan, go on.
And I thought David will never want to work with me again because I suggested the show. I knew Ruben from before. I interviewed him for the Lincoln Center Library for Performing Arts. So he was a friend, and he was a great friend until you got him into a studio and had to shoot his sets, his costume designs, etc. And then he wanted to be in the control room telling David what to do. It went on for hours, and I thought we'd never do another show together, and P.S., here we are some 30 years later. He couldn't get rid of me.
It's a match made in heaven, honest to God. I mean, I love the way the two of you played off each other to make things happen. I mean, in the book, it's so adorable the way you did play each other, to play your subjects, to get them to do what they needed to do for you. I mean, it's really an interesting dynamic. And I thought as interesting as some of the Hollywood legends whose stories you tell so beautifully in The Company of Legends. Does it take one to know one, David?
Oh, boy. You're trying to make me speechless, aren't you?
My job.
No, but the fact is that Joan and I do have different strengths, but you can tell from our different backgrounds we would inevitably have different kinds of strengths. And I think that's what made it work so well. Most of the stuff I didn't do well, Joan did well, and vice versa. So it was a good team.
But, you know, David, as we say in the book, or I say in the book, at a certain point I knew it was time for David to take over. He's a man, he's a director, and he's got a British accent. Foolproof.
What Joan's talking about here is those initial phone conversations when you are trying to persuade somebody to do something that they don't really want to do. Joan is one of the world's best schmoozers on the phone. Once she gets you on the phone, you're probably hooked. But there were occasions when she said, "No, David, you need to do this, and I'm not good at it." But I made myself, and we did manage to get a few people that wouldn't work on television otherwise.
To say the least.
It was basically with older stars, women, particularly older women stars, Ginger Rogers, Katharine Hepburn, the original Contact, Fred Astaire's sister Adele. Somehow or other, David was better at the initial contact with them.
But the thing that's so interesting to me, and I think it comes out in the book, is that you knew who needed to do what in order to make it work. Because I think that most people don't understand just how hard it really is sometimes to crack these people. Ask me, I do it for a living. How do you wend your way in? How do you get that phone number? How do you do? And we're going to talk about that in a minute. I want to ask you this before we go further, though. What does become a legend? Can you define what it is that the stars of yesteryear had? And I'm going to stay with yesteryear. We'll talk about current situation with stardom in a moment, but I don't know. Joan, why don't you take that one?
Well, I think the legends were created by the publicity mills of the old star of the old studio system. I think that in yesteryear, as you put it, it was a publicity mill and a studio system that educated, nurtured, and created the most valuable assets those studios had, which were their stars. And therefore, they were, as David has always said, they were on the big silver screen, not in your living room, and therefore they were just out of reach. A certain mystique.
Right. You had to leave your home to go and see these people. You went to see them in a big movie palace. So right. The setting was there for you to be somewhat in awe.
So, David, does Hollywood make legends like it used to? Is there even such a thing as stardust anymore?
Well, there is. There are some wonderful performers around. Let's not belittle what's going on in Hollywood today. There are some really terrific people around. But they don't have, well, I'm saying the benefit of the studio system to set them apart. And what they do have, which makes it tougher to be, let's say, a legend, is this television and this social media. So they're with us all the time. They're in our living rooms. They are on the computer or on our cell phones when we turn our cell phones on. We learn things about them that maybe we don't even want to know. We know a little bit too much. But as Joan pointed out, way back in the days of the studio system, the publicity was so carefully crafted that these people were always a little bit beyond our reach. They don't feel that way today.
I think it would be a lot harder for us to do a program today about somebody who is a current star, not even talking about the financing, which would be a nightmare, but that's beside the point. But I think now publicists and agents often forget who's the star and who's the representative. And therefore, they're completely controlled. Would we ever have hands off? Nobody ever asked us in the shows that we did what we're going to use or not use in those shows, and nobody told us or asked us to use or not use anything.
Oddly overhandled, and yet the studio was handling them, but it's a different kind of overhandling.
Yes, but by the time we got to them, of course, they were beyond the studio system.
Right.
And I called up Catherine Hepburn, and she picks up her own phone, which is a little bit daunting if you're at the other end.
To say the least. Let me just go down one other avenue before we get to the specifics of it first, because I want to make this very clear. First of all, your documentarians. I mean, that in itself is such a delicious art form. On the surface, as I said earlier, it seems like it's an easy job, right? It's not.
Our job is to make these shows look easy and easy to digest, of course, but what goes on behind the scenes is far from easy, as you all know.
Absolutely. But I mean, this is what's so interesting to me and what I want the audience to hear about that. And that's how you craft this whole thing, how you have to walk this fine line between the star, the publicist, the studio, everybody who's involved. Wow, that in itself is an art. Yes?
And Joni's very good at that.
thank you very much for saying that, Hallie. I don't know. You know, we never thought about it. It just, that's the way we operated. I don't know. I mean, I don't know the answer to, I think you're asking me a question as to whether we think it's an art. I don't know.
It's very much a case of when we were doing a job. We had a job. We had a certain amount of time with a certain amount of money to make a program that had to go on the air on a specific date, and we just did our job. And when you're doing it, you don't really think about it. You just say, how can we make this happen? It's only sometimes many years later that you look back and say, oh, my goodness.
I imagine that's exactly what happened in the writing of this book.
David,
get into the subjects. I mean, that to me is so much fun. I mean, it's not always easy. There's a great story in the Company of Legends about how you got to Sinatra, for instance. There's also a great Sinatra drunk story in the book. But let's talk about just how you would wend your way through to get to who you needed to get to. And I love the story with Sinatra because I get that one particularly.
Well, it was Joan's job to get Sinatra, at least. And frankly, in the end, she failed. And we had to turn to Katharine Hepburn, because we were doing the show with Katharine Hepburn about Spencer Tracy. And we didn't want to ask her we wanted to do our job without bothering her, as it were. But at a certain point, we realized we weren't getting what we needed. And when we told Kate, basically, we had him within 24 hours. She picks up the phone, and of course, he's going to do it.
Right. This, the Gilly Russo story, and the reason I bring because I was a kid.
Let Joan tell you that one.
Let me just tell you, there's a little background on me, which is when everybody else, when I was in high school, was like loving, you know, the Beatles, and I had Sinatra on my, and my sister, when he died, actually sent me a condolence card. I was crazy about this man. We stayed in
but
this
I can understand
house.
It.
Right? We stayed in his house in California once. It was crazy, absolutely crazy. But I was possessed with him, so I would go and hang out at Gilly's. I was like 16. So when you bring that up in the book, I was hysterical. Tell us about that.
My father played golf at times in Palm Springs, and he had once told me that Sinatra played at the same golf course he had played at, and that his entourage included a man named Gilly. That's all my father knew about Gilly. And I thought, wait a minute, that name sounds familiar. And I did a little research and realized that he's talking about Gilly Ritzo. and that there was a restaurant called Jilly's. And so I called that Palm Springs golf course and said, I'm trying to reach Mr. Jilly Rizzo. And they said, well, I think you should call the jewelry store on the Lexington Avenue side of the Waldorf Astoria. He hangs out there most afternoons. So I did.
Yeah, you did.
And a person answered the phone that sounded like a Warner Brothers gangster movie. Yeah, who's this? And I said, I'm looking, you know, I said, my name is Joan Kramer. You know, I'm from public television and I'm looking for Mr. Rizzo. Yeah, hold on. Well, the next voice I heard also sounded like from a gangster movie. Yeah, Jilly here, who's this? Well, that's how it happened. I mean, I sent a letter and then I lost track of Jilly, unfortunately. So that's when we went to Kate.
I love the story. I'm going to jump around a lot because thoughts coming in my head, I want to get it all in. I'm watching that clock and I'm freaking out because I thought I could do 2 hours with you guys and I've gotten less than that. So listen to me, Joan. Fred Astaire, Putting on Top Hat, and Fred Astaire, Chain Partners in Dance. David, this guy, he was a smart guy. He had sewn up everything. He owned everything about him, right? Which was not the usual thing in those days.
We actually survived and got to make that show through our own ignorance. We were not aware that his lawyer in the 30s had a clause in his contract which gave him control over the use of excerpts from his films. So when he basically said to us, go away, I don't want you to make a show about me, and our executive producer said, oh, go ahead, he's a public figure, you can do the show anyway, and we were pressing forward. What we didn't realize is that without his permission, we couldn't show any of his film clips. So we did keep asking, and we eventually got a call from his agent saying, because of your tenacity, Mr. Astaire has agreed to let you make the program. And my reaction, which I said to Joan at the time, was, well, a big deal. What I didn't realize, it was a big deal. We couldn't have made the show without him. But this is where your ignorance sometimes is the best thing to have, because we would have given up if we'd known that.
What'd you think of him, Joan?
Oh, well, I was fascinated, you know, having been a dancer. He was debonair. He was dressed exquisitely. And he was very shy. I did not work for the Cavett Show when he was on the show. That was before my time, so I didn't meet him at that point when he did two 90-minute programs for Dick. But when I met him, I was ecstatic, ecstatic and terrified, because he was known to be a perfectionist. And frankly, showing him a rough cut in those days was really rough.
What we haven't said is that with the phone call that said, because of your tenacity, he's agreed to let you do the show, there was a sting in the tail. He asked to see a rough cut.
Oh, that's the worst.
Yes. So we were terrified because his reputation was for being extremely tough. He'd been known to have an RKO recall prints of films if he saw them in the theaters and he didn't like something about it. So and his choreographing partner, Hermes Pan, when we told him about this, pulled a face and said, kind of, good luck with that.
But it all went well. In fact, you did, what, three shows about him or two shows about him?
We did two initially.
And then one 10 years later.
Yeah, amazing. And you probably could go back and do more because, boy, what a talent and, boy, what a body of work that guy had. Let's go back. Let's go to Miss Katharine Hepburn. Oh, my God. Can I just tell you, the stories abound in this book, and one is just better than the other. Honest to God. Talk to me about this lady. What was your first impression, Jim?
My first impression?
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, I was around enough stars to know to not be intimidated, although she could be intimidating at the beginning. My first impression was, my God, this is a real person living in a townhouse that was very comfortable. Her feet were up. You know, there was nothing touch-me-not about the house. And immediately we were served tea and her recipe that her housekeeper made for flourless chocolate brownies, which are unbelievably sinful, and Seduta's mocha chip ice cream, which was her favorite. And automatically she puts you at ease. She put us at ease because, as we found out later, and as she said to somebody when we were there with a member of the crew, and there was not an extra chair for that crew member, she said, just a minute, I'll be right back. And she walked to another room and came in carrying an overstuffed chair over her head. And she said, nobody is uncomfortable in this house.
David, she had not, up until that point, talked publicly about her relationship with Spencer Tracy. And even the press had respected the privacy of that. Talk to me about that.
Yes, it went to, it was to the extent that every interviewer, whoever interviewed her, knew that once, if the subject of Spencer Tracy was raised, that was probably the end of the interview. And as you say, the gossip columnists of the time respected that and never mentioned it. So when she called Joan one morning and said, now that I have friends in public television, let's do a show about Spencer together, you can imagine our reaction. It was a sign of trust on her part, which I think we're still somewhat staggered by, because we had done a show about her, but not that she'd given us her permission to make, just as Fred Astaire had, but she couldn't be on it because she was on the road with a play, West Side Waltz, and so she couldn't appear on the show, but she said, yes, go ahead and make it, and she cooperated. And in a way, that was her testing us, because she obviously liked what we'd done, and it was after that show that Joan got that call, let's do a show about Spencer together. It's quite remarkable.
We asked her, why now, when you never would talk about him? And she said, I couldn't do that show while Louise Tracy, who was Mrs. Spencer Tracy, was alive, because it was important for Louise Tracy to remain Mrs. Tracy for the work she was doing for the blind. You know, she established, with Spencer's help, the John Tracy Clinic, named after their son, who was born profoundly deaf, which eventually affected his eyesight. And so she never wanted to get in the way of Louise Tracy and that work that she felt was very important, which it was. And she said, but Louise Tracy has now passed away, and I feel it's okay.
Unbelievable. And worked with his daughter on this as well, right?
Yes, and she was friends with that daughter. And we're still friends with that daughter.
Well, I'd like to talk to that daughter.
Terrific.
Really great story. Listen, this is another thing that the sleuthing you guys do on some of these projects. You learn that the rumor that Judy Garland actually sang President Kennedy asleep singing Somewhere Over the Rainbow was true, even though Jackie Kennedy said at first it wasn't. And that's a great part of the book, so everybody's got to pick up this book. Let's not tell them the answer to all of that. But you also bust a lot of myths. And one of them, and I love this, was Johnny Carson had a crazy reputation for being very difficult to work with. That was not your experience, was it, David?
We were very pleasantly surprised. When we finally landed him to host a show about Jimmy Stewart, obviously we always do our research, and we discovered that certainly in his early days, he had a very bad reputation, Johnny I'm talking about, and he admitted himself that he drank too much in those days. He was also known to be cold and aloof, and as you probably know, he very rarely did anything other than the Tonight Show. He'd occasionally host the Oscars, but that was it. So to land him was really an amazing coup, and we thought, what's this experience going to be like? Is it going to be difficult? But the first day we actually worked with him on camera, he was with Jimmy, and they were terrific together. They were genuine friends. It wasn't an act. When you saw Jimmy on Johnny's show, on The Tonight Show, and you say, oh, they're just performing for the camera. No, they really genuinely liked each other. But then we had a shoot a few weeks later, which was Johnny alone, and I remember saying to Joan, I'm afraid we might now see the real Johnny Carson. This might be a tough day. It never was. He was absolutely terrific. We just relished working with him. It was a wonderful experience.
And
nothing like the rumors and the stories you've heard.
We stayed in touch, and we talked on the phone, and he invited us to a taping of The Tonight Show about 8 months or a year later, and we went back to talk to him. And we actually asked him to do some more shows, and he said, find me a subject that I care about as much as I care about Jimmy Stewart, and I'll do it. But I'm not going to do anybody he said, I'd be thrilled to work with you again, but I'm not going to do anybody that I don't care about, truly care about. And we asked him to do a show about Jack Benny, whom he really adored. And he said, I would have leapt at doing that show if Jack were alive. I cannot go on camera and talk to nobody. I'm not good at that.
Amazing. Great quote in the book by Gore Vidal about the marriage of Paul Newman and Joanne Woodward. It works so well because they have nothing in common. Maybe that's the secret.
Another of the great wits, of course.
Absolutely, absolutely. That Paul Newman was a practical joker. Oh, my God. The funniest story in the world, when you pick up the phone, Joan, and call, and he plays one on you. Tell us quickly.
Oh, it happened a lot. And I don't know why. I mean, I'm not the biggest genius in the world, but I'm not the biggest dummy either. And I fall headline and foot, what do you call that expression? Foot, something, something, and sinker. What do you call that?
Hook, line, and sinker.
I fell right into the trap, and I'm carrying on. And Dave, whenever David hears me repeat that story to somebody, David falls on the floor because he's used to this kind of craziness from me.
Unbelievable. And you know, let's not be specific, because again, pick up this great book in the company of legends. Play a game with me, guys. Okay, I'm going to throw out some names. I want the first impression, the first word that comes to mind. Okay, David, Johnny Carson.
Well, I think I kind of done that for you. A charming, wonderful person to work with. I would leap at working with him again if it were possible.
Joan, Nancy Reagan.
Charming, nice, easy to talk to, friendly. She and Ronald Reagan were willing to talk to us forever. They had other things to do that afternoon, so the person in charge of the television department there didn't want us to stick around, but they kept talking. It was wonderful. I liked her a lot.
David, Ginger Rogers.
Oh, Ginger Rogers. Well, she was one of those people I had to persuade to come on the show. She said yes. I won't tell you how, but yes, we got her to agree to be on the show. She said, I'll do my own makeup and my own hair. Come to my place and I'll be ready at 2:00. And she was ready before we were. One of the things I learned is that the stars from the old studio system were very, very disciplined. If they said they'd be ready at a certain time, they were ready usually before we were. She was charming, and she gave some wonderful stories. After that initial resistance, she gave us some great stuff.
Okay, how about Audrey Hepburn, Joan?
Oh, well, Hallie, I mean, that was somebody that I always wanted to meet. And when she agreed to do the Fred Astaire songbook and be its host, I was delighted. I expected her to be beautiful. She was. I expected her to be charming. She was. I expected her to be elegant. She was. What I didn't expect is that she was funny. She offered to do the whole show with a Cockney accent when she found out that David was from Britain.
How about Henry Fonda, David?
Henry, we met Henry just after he'd finished on Golden Pond, and we were doing that first show about Katharine Hepburn, and we were setting up to interview him, and he came out to watch the crew getting ready, and I went over to talk to him, just to chat, and I decided to try asking him. I said, let me tell you some of the questions we're going to ask you so you can get your thoughts together. And I went through every question, and every question he said, I don't have anything to say about that. What was astounding, and this in showbiz, it happened not just with Henry but with others, that we sat him in front of the camera, turned on the lights and rolled the camera, and suddenly he had a lot to say.
Isn't that amazing about those kind of people? And I'm glad that you said that, because that was really where I was going with the next one, because Katharine Hepburn talked to you about Katharine Hepburn, the character, right? And Jimmy Stewart, you saw him, you said the first time he looked like an old bent man, and then he appears on camera and va va voom, he's alive and hilarious, right?
Yes,
crazy.
Yes, it's lights, camera, action, and then the movie star appears.
I just absolutely love that. Absolutely love that.
Katharine Hepburn referred to herself as that creature on the screen, and it was her job as Katharine Hepburn to keep that creature fascinating.
And fascinating she kept it, that is for sure. Joan, I'm going to bust you, Joan. Joan, you have a penchant for collecting mementos.
I know where you're going, yes.
Yes, Frank Sinatra, the White House. You like to leave with things? They are wonderful little...
Before anybody gets the impression that I'm a kleptomaniac, we're talking about paper towels from the bathroom that you're meant to use and throw in the wastebasket.
I never really understood this.
David never got it.
I get it.
You get it. I mean, the White House has the presidential seal imprinted on it in gold in the dispenser in the ladies' room. I wasn't going to leave without paper towels from the White House.
I like the fact that you didn't leave with just one or two, though. You took a chunk and off you go.
I did.
That's hilarious. And then in Sinatra's house, under bodyguard, you're stealing. Love it.
Oh, I thought I was going to wind up, you know, with the bodyguard saying to me, what are you doing? And then I realized, you know, they probably don't have a camera in the bathroom, because he had cameras all over the property, monitors. And then when I took the paper towels, David almost had a fit when I said to him, David, I forgot to tell you what I stole from Frank Sinatra's house. I was being funny. Only David didn't find that. What did you take from that house?
Exactly. So listen, guys, I hate to have to wrap this up, but I do. You've been sprinkled with stardust. You've breathed that rarefied air of the famous. What's the most important thing that you learned about stardom along the way? Is celebrity all that it's cracked up to be, or maybe it's always been? Is it about illusion? I love the word illusion. And is illusion alive and kicking now? Talk to me, David.
You're right. It is an illusion, but it's also something that these ordinary people had to live. They knew how to live it. They knew how to maintain that illusion that had been so carefully created for and about them. We'll never see their likes again. We were lucky that it happened to us at a particular time, that we stumbled across this format of programming that had gone dormant. Not that nobody had ever done it before, but we started it up again, and we had our pick of these most wonderful people.
Joan?
Yes, Stardust does still, an illusion probably still exists today, but it's not in the same way. It's just not the same. And I'm prejudiced, perhaps, but I have a right to be, I think. I think we had the cream of the crop, certainly from the golden age of what is known as the golden age of Hollywood. Maybe today people will look back on now as the golden age of movie making. And there's wonderful movies, as David said earlier, and wonderful stars, but it's not quite the same.
I've been speaking with documentarians and authors Joan Kramer and David Healy. Their book is In the Company of Legends, with a foreword by Richard Dreyfuss, and pictures courtesy of the authors, available wherever books are sold. For more information on David Healy and Joan Kramer, visit their Facebook page at So What Are You Going to Do Next? Before I go, I want to remind everyone that podcasts of current and past shows are always available to listen to free on iTunes under The Hallie Kasser-Jane Show. The Hallie Kasser-Jane Show is also available for download via Spreaker.com, Stitcher.com, BlogTalkRadio.com, and a host of other venues. Google The Hallie Kasser-Jane Show and you will find us. Of course, podcasts of our shows, both past and present, are always posted for your listening pleasure at HallieKasserJane.com. I'll be back next week, same time, 3 p.m. Eastern, for another edition of The Hallie Kasser-Jane Show, brought to you by Audible.com. Get a free audiobook download at www.audibletrial.com/ The Hallie Kasser-Jane Show. Audible.com features over 100,000 titles to choose from for your iPhone, Android, Kindle, or MP3 player. Stay in touch, won't you? Remember, that's HallieKasserJane.com. Discover us on Facebook at HallieKasserJane and on Twitter at HallieCJ. I love to hear from you. So, till we meet again, this is Hallie Kasser-Jane. It's a wrap.